Welcome to the Denim & Boots podcast, the show for people who love heritage style and honest craftsmanship. Themed Made in Japan, in this second season, we talk to influencers and industry insiders to learn more about why Japan has been so influential for heritage style menswear. My name is Thomas, aka Denim Hunters, and I'll be your host in this episode. And with me today, I have Nick Clements, the founder of Mensfile and photographer of style, men's style, since the 70s. So great to have you here, Nick.
Hi, Thomas. Thank you for inviting me on your podcast.
You're very welcome. Yeah, it's a real pleasure. So, Nick, I think we met, I'd say, a handful of years ago, maybe early 2010s, probably in Berlin, which was and still is a place to meet people within our niche. But tell the listeners a bit about who you are and what you do.
Well, that's a good question because it's a long story. I guess ultimately I was a professional fashion photographer, and at one point, your career starts to go downwards. That's just normal and natural. It's a little bit like the music business. So I decided that I would diversify, and I tried to learn how to write and to be a journalist and write about the things in which I was interested, which were basically about male subcultures. Mm-hmm. And that led me naturally through to style, because the subcultures I was interested in were style-based subcultures. And ultimately, it ended up in the form of a magazine. And there was a big lead up to Mensfile. It actually took at least 10 years to arrive at Mensfile. There were other booklets and pamphlets and other publications which were similar to Mensfile. But eventually, Mensfile formed out of that interest, that intense interest in style-based subcultures.
Yeah. Yeah, I see on your website that You call yourself the cultural pamphleteer?
No, the subcultural pamphleteer. Are you aware of that term pamphleteer? Have you heard that before?
No, I mean, I know what pamphlet is. Now, before we get to the interview, I just wanted to remind you that you can find the show notes for this episode and all the other episodes on denimhunters.com. You can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like it, please leave a rating and a review. It really helps us. Now, let's get back to the interview.
Yeah, sure. I mean, a pamphlet, of course, is a small booklet. But the pamphleteers were people back in the end of the 18th century, so 1780s, 1790s, who created these small booklets, usually on philosophical ideas or political ideas, and distributed them in taverns and coffee houses in places like Amsterdam or London, or actually in the United States. And one of the most famous pamphleteers was a British man, excuse me, called Thomas Paine. And he was involved in the development of the American Constitution, even though he was British. And he then ended up actually following through with the French Revolution, ended up in jail, got in a lot of trouble because of his political ideas. But he distributed those and disseminated them through pamphlets. And that's what a pamphleteer is.
Right, right. I mean, that makes sense. So you just do it, I mean, less violently, I guess, with style instead of political arguments.
Yes, I don't get involved in anything dangerous like political ideas. But I do talk about style and where it comes from. And there is a kind of sometimes a political analysis of that in terms of class and culture and so forth.
Mm-hmm. But tell us, Nick, I mean, how did it start? Because you can also read on your website that it started in the 70s. I mean, so you've been doing it for, you know, four decades now, I guess. Or I mean, how did it start with you?
Well, it started with surfing. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up in Australia. I grew up in the west side of England. But Australian lifeguards would come on a kind of year tour of Britain, and they realized they could get a job as a paid lifeguard in the west side of England. And they brought with them the idea of the Surf Lifesaving Club. which came from Australia. It's almost like a kind of grown-up Boy Scouts for surf lifesaving. There's drills and you follow procedures and so forth in ways of saving people who are drowning, but in big surf. And from that came lots of sports which revolve around surf riding. And I joined the Surf Lifesaving Club when I was about 12. And from there, realized that there was a whole surfing subculture of various surfing subcultures. The information was disseminated through two magazines, Surfer Magazine and Surfing. And we could eventually, they came out of California, San Clemente, and we could eventually get those through these little kind of homemade surfing shops that would import them from the United States. And I guess that was my first idea that you could be involved in something secret, elite, exclusive, and very stylish. That was where it all started. And from that, I got into photographing the people involved and the objects, you know, surfboards or surf cars and so forth. And when I eventually moved to London, I found out there were people involved in other similar underground cultures. And one of the biggest was what I call revival, which is basically dressing like you live in the 40s or the 50s, driving a 40s or 50s car, living in a 40s or 50s house. And that's where it really started. And that's when I started to photograph people seriously. And that was in the late 1970s.
Right. And you were, so what's your education? Did you train as a photographer then, or what did you do?
Thomas, because of your age and everything, and I think there's such a different, in the past 40 years, Britain came through a kind of, 60 years, I should say, Britain came through a kind of different social structure. And university education didn't become important in Britain until fairly recently, I would say in the past 25 years. Mm-hmm. Before that, I think when I was growing up, only 5% of the population went to university, and I certainly wasn't going to be one of them. I had a job. I left school at 17 on Friday, and I had a job for the next Monday, and I've been working ever since. So there was no training. It was just looking at what other people did and effectively copying it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess, I'm sure things have changed, but I mean, so you left school at 17 and started working. You started taking photographs already then?
Yeah. Just as a hobby. I think what I was thinking at the time was how I love style. I love men's fashion. How can I turn that into some kind of job? And I did know people who were studying fashion design and so forth, but that was never going to be me. I already didn't have the high school qualifications, so that would never have happened. And also, I like to have money in my pocket. And so I always had a job, just doing various things, nothing connected with fashion. And I looked at a lot of fashion magazines. At that point, a very important photographer was breaking through, and I saw his photography in British Vogue and tried to copy it. I mean, sounds very naive, but what I realized is that although he was using models, he was also finding people out of subcultural backgrounds, and they seemed to have more credibility, more plausibility as models. And I tried to do the same thing, and it eventually worked. So it took a bit of time, though.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and then you said Men's File, which is, it was started in 2008 or?
Yes, 2009, yes.
2009, so you're celebrating 10 years this year. But you said it took around 10 years before, you know, the lead up, to the publication of Men's File.
Yes, I actually published a sociological book called Simulacra, which means literally, it's a Latin term for simulation, so a copy. And it was all about the revival and replica scene that was happening in Japan. And that book led me into academic study. And then I did a Master of Philosophy at the Royal College of Art in London.
Okay.
And that led me into other new areas. And that's how I tried to learn about writing effectively. Not to say that I'm a good writer, but I did sit down and try to become a better writer.
So you, okay, so you got a master's degree then in sociology?
Master of Philosophy, actually, in the fashion department of the Royal College of Art.
Very interesting. So,
but that was that was only 12 years ago.
And that was, but what, why did you start Men's File then?
Men's File actually came out of that postgraduate degree partly. I decided that I would try to explain to my tutors and my supervisors what revival was, because what was fascinating, and this is quite interesting, the Royal College of Art is one of the highest educational institutions of its kind in the world, and the people teaching fashion there are incredibly knowledgeable and incredibly adept at everything that connected with fashion, but not everything. And I realized they were not aware of a lot of contemporary male subcultures, because there's a menswear department in that school. And so they'd never really heard of revival. They'd never heard of replica clothing. They hadn't been exposed to the denim scene to any extent. And I wanted to show them that it was already really well established. And so to do that, I did one edition of a magazine. And then that turned into something which ultimately went out of control and Men's File was born.
Hmm. But I mean, so this was the mid, I mean...
This was 10 years ago, 12 years ago.
And, but I mean, how established was the revival or heritage style scene even? I mean, because it's, I guess it's quite interesting that your tutors didn't know about it, because I would say, I mean, it maybe also, didn't it go a little under the radar even maybe 10, 15 years ago or
sure. I mean, I think first of all, fashion people, and I put fashion in inverted commas in quotations, that yeah. Often totally reject that part, that they actually think that anything that involves open copying isn't interesting or isn't worth thinking about. So there is an element of that, but they didn't realize how exclusive and elite some of these scenes were and how much they were actually influencing contemporary fashion, contemporary street fashion. And I mean, you can trace revival style in England and in the United States back to the late 70s. Well, you can trace it back to the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
There was a revival of rock and roll music in 71, 72, 73. And there was a very important movie, American Graffiti, followed by another important movie called Two Lane Blacktop. And those two movies kind of inspired a generation who often was probably 15, 16, 17 at the time. Punk then came along. A lot of those people got involved with punk because punk had a revivalist element. The people who were not pure punk were often wearing 50s and 60s clothing. I mean, you just think of the mainstream bands like Blondie and so forth. They were wearing 1960s pastiche stuff. But so were lots of others, Elvis Costello, a lot of those mainstream bands. So punk introduced revival at another level, slightly more avant-garde level. And then straight after punk, rockabilly came along. And so you had 18, 19, 20-year-old people who had been introduced to revival by movies like American Graffiti, which was effectively about hot rod racing, or Two Lane Blacktop. And then a movie came out, I think in 81, called The Loveless, which was a revival movie about motorcycle gangs in the 1950s. And all those things all came together and a scene happened which went underground quite quickly. And Japanese people picked up on that scene and the whole thing kind of took off in Japan in the early 1980s. And that's really the beginning. That's the true beginning of our story with Men's File, going back to that beginning period, which in Japan they call the bubble period, because of the economic bubble at the time,
mm.
put the value of the yen very high, which meant that Japanese people could travel very cheaply and buy secondhand clothing very cheaply. And that's where the scene that you're in, Thomas, the denim scene, and the scene that I'm in, which is more about revival style and objects and things, they both started more or less at that point. And the seed that was planted in Japan has grown into a mighty tree.
Yeah. So you said earlier that you went out to Japan already back then, or when was your first
visit? No, my first visit to Japan was in the early 1990s.
Okay. But I mean, but by then you were already, you know, living the revival style, I guess.
Oh, yes. Fashions change all the time. And there were a hardcore group of people in London, men. There were some women, but it's mainly a male phenomenon, who had started with revival, started with the London club scene of the early 80s. Clubs like the Wag Club or the Beatroot, and they had got into the 50s scene and the 50s look, and then the 40s look. Zoot suits came along and lasted about 3 months, but people built on those ideas and brought in these fast change fashions from the past. Mm. And the first commercial manifestation of this, or one of the first, came through shops. And the one that was the most directional was the Duffer of St. George. And the people who ran it had come through the process which I've just described.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't sell revival goods. They actually had really early on tuned into this idea of replicas and improvements on mid-century designs, and they mixed it with American streetwear. And so again, the whole street scene that you see today, which mixes American sportswear with high quality denims with mid-century clothing, manifested itself in the first store in London, at least at Duffer of St. George. And I think that was probably the first store of its kind outside of Japan. And they sold Japanese goods as well.
Already in the 80s then?
Well, certainly early 90s, yes. And actually so did American Classics, who may well have been the first, if not the first, the second store to import Japanese replica items from companies like Toyo Enterprises or Dry Bones very, very early on.
Hmm. So you went to Japan in the early 90s.
Yes.
And what was that like for you?
Well, it was amazing because they were making replicas of original clothing that was so rare. If you wanted the original, you just couldn't find it pre-internet. It was impossible to find things.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe somebody would make a replica of an amazing 1940s college sweatshirt. You're never going to find an original, not before the internet. It would have been impossible. But you knew they existed because you saw them in photographs. And there'll be a company in Japan, a small brand or a big brand, making a replica from something they'd bought in the States. And it just blew my mind, basically. It meant that you could wear mid-century clothing every day as normal clothing. And for me, that was huge.
Did you collect clothing then? What would you wear before this then?
I think at that time I was very much in tune with the same kind of stuff that the Duffer of St. George were doing. So it was mixing American sportswear. And actually Polo Ralph Lauren was doing mixing American sportswear with mid-century stuff with salvaged denims. And of course, you could buy Redline Levi's and stuff at that point that, you know, were only 10 years old or whatever. So you could get hold of salvaged denims. They were about, when I arrived in Japan, original salvage denims were everywhere that had been bought up during the bubble period by Japanese collectors. But of course, people had started to make replicas by the mid-90s.
So if we go back then to you starting Men's File 10 years ago.
Yeah.
How did, tell us about, what happened? You launched the first magazine and you said it was sort of a project to show your tutors that there was actually something called Revival Style.
Yeah. And that there were all these brands and there was a whole marketplace and all the rest of it.
But what was was that really the, I'm sure you must have had some ideas of okay, there could be more issues or what was that like?
Well, it coincided. Things usually happen because there's a coincidence of lots of different factors, and this was no different. The Ralph Lauren brand RRL had actually been in existence for quite a time, but about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, the company decided to push it really hard. Japanese replica brands were starting to appear because of the internet, because of denim forums and so forth, were starting to appear in the United States and Britain and all over Europe. Just the beginnings, but they were there. A whole bunch of things coincided together. I guess the hipster phenomenon, which is a kind of mixture of so many elements, from mid-century tattoos to contemporary politics, but there's a lot borrowed from the mid-century period. Motorcycles, custom motorcycles and so forth, they all took off at the same time. And for the first time, people that have been in almost unknowable subcultures actually thought, oh gosh, maybe I can make some kind of small business out of this, because I don't think anybody's ever made any money out of this, but they could somehow get by, maybe. From being a tattoo artist who specialized in mid-century tattoos, or a bike builder that built, mid-century style custom bikes or whatever. Before, they couldn't make a living. They could do it as a hobby, but they couldn't make a living. And I think the hipster phenomenon actually created some money in that environment. And it was the same with Men's File. People wanted inspiration. They're not going to get inspiration from mainstream consumer magazines. They might not be purist enough to read a hobby magazine, a real genuine purist magazine, because they got wider interests. And Men's File was kind of accessible, at the same time, sincere. Or at least that would be, it's not for me to say whether Men's File is sincere, but we would like it to be sincere. It's heartfelt. We love everything we're writing about. I've been involved in a lot of the things I'm writing about for 30 or 40 years. Doesn't mean I know everything about them. It doesn't mean there isn't somebody out there who could do better. It just means that I hope we have some credibility because of the way we approach the subject matter. But it is very broad and it is accessible. We don't intentionally shut people out by trying to create a language which nobody can understand, which a lot of hobby magazines do, of course. They want to show that if you're not a purist into old cars or old bikes, then you won't understand the magazine. So Men's File is accessible, which is why I think it works in Japan and other countries as well.
So what's the frequency now, and what has been sort of the publishing?
It's always been twice a year.
Right. Twice a year.
Yes.
And along, doing the magazine, you kept doing freelance work with photography and yes. video.
Yes. Well, yeah. Just doing anything to scrape together a living. let's face it. In terms of business, magazines are on their way out. All magazines. Nothing to do with Men's File. And it's actually, the only way you can stay in business with a magazine is to create an object which people want to collect. If it's a throwaway, people aren't going to buy it because they can get that same information from the internet.
Exactly.
It's also something which people, I think, still enjoy. Men's File represents a sort of 6 monthly journey where myself and my two colleagues, Dan and Matt, they go around, or we go around, and we see things and we pull them in, and then we join them all together and give people a single experience of information. Mm. And I know for a fact that people will see things for the first time in Men's File and go out and explore them. For example, we've actually got a great photographer colleague. He's called Zoltan Papp. He's a brilliant photographer, and he's actually a brilliant wildlife photographer, but he also is very interested in historic motorsport. So last winter, he went to Insel, which is a frozen lake in Austria, to see the ice racing around the lake. Now, lots of people who are into historic racing do not know about that. It's also very stylish. There's a lot of Porsches, mid-century Porsches taking part and so forth. So I genuinely think that Men's File does introduce people to new things, and then they will go and check them out. They'll go to Insel, they'll go and see it, or they'll find out more on the internet. So I'd like to think we don't just take the first thing that comes along.
It's more than fashion. It's like, you know, it's the subculture, which is I guess very much your thing. So it's, you know, it's not only about the clothes, and I think that's also something that I'm sure readers appreciate, that you get more of the lifestyle.
Well, I think there's something important here, Thomas, because the subculture, It's become a very popular word to describe anything that isn't mainstream. But true subcultures, of course, are very local and they're very exclusive. So I couldn't say, as an old man, that I'm in any subcultures, because you've got different levels. I think we deal with subcultural style, which is it's the style that comes out of these exclusive and elite and very local groups, which could be anywhere, but we're kind of pick up on it, and we will try to explain it, if you like. But there's another level, which is hobbyists, and these are very dedicated people. They're not so exclusive. In other words, they don't push people out and say, you can't come into our world, but they are often purists, or they are very dedicated, like you're dedicated to denim. Mm. It's not a subculture, but it's part of the hobbyist world, and an extremely respectable part as well. And it's got followers, and there's a dress code, or there are many dress codes, and there's a language and all those other things. And that's, so we start at the extreme end with subculture and then go over to hobbyist culture as well. But it has to be about style. If it's not stylish, we don't feature it.
Hmm. All right. So, I mean, if we talk a bit about, you know, Japan again, I mean, being also the theme of this entire season, and one of the reasons I wanted to have you on is, you know, you, a few years back, is it 3 years or something, or four maybe, you partnered with Clutch for Men's File.
Yes, 5 years ago.
5 years ago already, yeah.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
Well, I was literally, Japan, we were selling very well in Japan. Mm-hmm. And I was literally sending out 10,000 copies of the magazine out of my bedroom. And in the end, it was and not making any money out of it. In fact, it was probably costing money. And in the end, I just couldn't do it anymore. It was literally 24/7, and doing all the administration, all the shipping documents. I mean, it was just impossible. But I did it for 5 years. And I just thought, I can't go on with this anymore. And the Clutch magazine said, look, maybe you can partner with us. And it was a wonderful suggestion. And we already loved Clutch, and we loved what they were doing. And also we'd already been inspired by older publications from the same publishing company, like Lightning, mm-hmm. And other publications like Nalu, which is a mid-century surfing magazine, which they publish. Many. There's a more of a fashion-y publication called Second. So there's this whole group of publications that we were already inspired by. And when they said, well, why don't you join in with us? It was it was a great suggestion. And yes, I can, that's really all I can say. It's working out very well, and we do everything we can to support Clutch. It's a great organization. And of course, now there's Clutch Cafe. So yeah. If ever you can't get hold of Men's File or Clutch, you can get it from Clutch Cafe in the center of London in Great Portland Street.
Is about your involvement with the store?
Oh, I have no involvement with the store whatsoever, except I'm a regular visitor. Spending money there is one of my involvements.
But going back to, I mean, I'm curious about, you know, magazines in Japan, because I mean, I've only been in this business, or you know, this part of the heritage, the style, fashion scene, whatever you want to call it, for 10-12 years. But magazines in Japan have been influential for decades, right?
There were two magazines. I mean, there were two very influential magazines. One is, which unfortunately doesn't exist anymore, called Free and Easy, a very, very important magazine. And the other one, in terms of collecting replica items and so forth, is Lightning, which is part of A Publishing, which is the company which owns Clutch. These through the 90s and early 2000s, I mean, these were incredibly influential publications, which effectively catalogued collections of mid-century clothing. So they would have, and they're still doing it, but there would be a theme. I don't know. Let's say Redline Levi's, or let's say pre-1950s Levi's, or whatever, and they would dig out from collectors in Japan every single possible variation on that theme, photograph them on a white background like a catalog, and printed in a magazine in date order, chronological order, a little bit of English usually, so you could kind of figure out what was going on, and maybe with some original photography to put the items in context. And around that, the way that they turned that into a marketplace was, at the same time, of course, you had important brands like The Real McCoys or Full Count making replica clothing. And that was those magazines became media for those companies producing replica stuff to show what they could do and actually make a comparison with the original. So they were incredibly important, and you could buy those at the Duffer of, or maybe you couldn't buy them, but they had them at the Duffer of St. George in the 19 or late 90s, early 2000s. And they also had them in another very important directional store, which was called Nick Ashley. Nick Ashley is a designer, but he's also a very, very proficient. That's really understating it. He's an amazing motorcyclist. He, not just collecting old bikes, which he does, not just being able to fix them and build them, which he can, but he races them at a very high level. But he was a very, very successful designer, and his store had a lot of those Japanese magazines. There were also magazines that were specialist on motorcycles and so forth. There was one called Clubman, which showed you how to make Japanese-based replicas of British bikes, for example. So there were. It wasn't just fashion. There were lots of other Japanese magazines that focused on mid-century objects and explained them and showed you how you could make your own version, basically.
So, I mean, you said you 5 years ago were sending out 10,000 copies of your Men's File. How many of those went to Japan?
Probably half through either personal order. I wasn't sending out 10,000 individual copies. That wouldn't have been possible. But, you know, in boxes of 50 or whatever. Maybe a few thousand. I mean, a lot for us, because we were selling across Asia as well. We were selling in Taiwan, in Shanghai, Hong Kong, Seoul, literally all over. But Japan was a very significant market. And it's because Men's File was inspired by magazines like Lightning, simple as that. So I think it was something they recognized. But the only difference is we didn't catalog items. We did something else. We took our skills as fashion photographers, you know, for that we'd work for significant fashion magazines, we took those same skills and we turned them on, not on models, but on subculture members, revivalists, hobbyists, who looked very, very stylish. And that's something that nobody had done before. I don't really think anybody's doing it now, but I mean, you know, you'll get the occasional photo shoot where they turn the camera on, in inverted commas, real people. But we weren't just looking for real people. We were looking for style leaders. And 98% of people that are featured in Men's File actually influence style, whether it's contemporary modern fashion or whether it's other types of style, but they tend to be men or women. They tend to be style leaders. So we sought out those style leaders and photographed them using the same techniques you would to photograph for a magazine like, you know, Vogue or whatever. So yeah, that was new. So Men's File has a unique selling point, and it is that we seek out those style leaders and then we photograph them using the same techniques you use for fashion magazines. And it ends up looking like a movie. And that's the way we do it. There are other photographers who have done it, but we changed it slightly and we came in from a new angle.
But, you know, talking about Japan then, but also the magazine scene over there. I mean, from what I can gather, magazines are still to this day, I guess, more successful, even though, you know, Free and Easy, rest in peace. But I guess magazines are still more influential, at least have been in Japan than the rest of the world.
It certainly seems that way. I mean, people still buy books. People still buy magazines in Japan. Yes, that's completely correct. There's no question about that. I'm just saying on a world level, obviously, the only way you can keep a magazine going is if it's a collector's item. And that's why Clutch and Men's File and Lightning and Second and the others are still going, because people keep them, they file them, and they collect them. That's a fact.
So that's why you think magazines are more successful, you know, relatively in Japan than maybe in Europe or the US?
Yeah. Well, I think people are more likely to collect a magazine generally than people would be in Europe or the US. But again, with Men's File, I'm not trying to sell Men's File, because there are other magazines people do this with. But with Men's File, whether you're in the US or Japan, people keep them and file them away. That's, I think, the only way you can keep yourself going. I mean, there's a great publication in Britain, for example. It's not part of our company, but a great publication called The Automobile. It's a private company, and they print exclusive stories on extremely rare cars that nobody else has access to. I think people wait every month for that to come out and collect them, and that's why they're still in business. If it's not a collector's item, I think it's probably hard to keep a magazine going today.
So, but going back to Japan and
style. Sorry, Thomas, I keep leaving Japan, sorry.
No worries. I mean, but you know, you've been to Japan for what, maybe coming up on 30 years, you know,
yeah.
And going there,
yes.
And work with Japanese, been doing that for 5 years.
Yes.
You know a lot about Japan and Japanese style, but what makes it different?
Well, I think we're touching on it with this. I use that word hobbyist. Of course, you have the Japanese term otaku, meaning somebody who is a geek or a nerd or totally dedicated to something, a hobbyist. It exists as a word because it's a common trait. People, I mean, I'm sure there's sociological reasons, which I don't know enough about Japan about to say exactly what they are, but we can note the phenomenon that Japanese people seem capable of focusing on one idea and following it through to its ultimate conclusion, whatever that may be. And with fashion and style, they're no different. If you want to find the ultimate collectors in almost anything, but especially 20th century objects and styles, you will find them in Japan. It's something respectable in doing that. I think certainly in Britain, being a nerd, being otaku, is maybe not that, it's not something that people think is amazing. Whereas I think in Japan, it's a totally respectable position to have. I mean, I love the fact that I'm a sort of otaku type. I've always enjoyed that. I've enjoyed the sort of slight social rejection and everything, but not everybody wants that. But in Japan, if you're a collector, if you're an enthusiast, if you're a hobbyist, it's a totally legitimate and respectable thing to be. And I think that explains it.
But what about then, you know, so that has then affected how they, in the already starting, I mean, going back to the 60s, even 70s, 80s as well, you know, their interest in reproducing, you know, what you would call revival style then, everything here, or was the link then?
Well, there seems to be, yes, I mean, again, this is something that I think you could make just, you could make 10 programs on, which is about making replicas of things. It's not, of course, it's not only Japanese people that make replicas, not at all. But what Japan has done in industry is take what the West did after the Second World War, look at it for 10 or 20 years, and then make a much better version. So they've already established that as a methodology. So if you think of motorcycles or cars or any of those things, they studied what the West did very carefully and then made a similar version, only usually a lot better, a lot more reliable and so forth. So I think this idea of taking something and making it better, we would have to go back into Japanese history of ceramics from Korea, ceramics from China, lots of other things, but we're going back now 1,000 years to see whether there is a pattern in that. And I can't say for sure there is, but certainly in the 20th century, this idea of taking an existing idea and improving on it is certainly something that seems to be very viable in Japan, and then sell it back to the rest of the world, which is a fantastic situation. I mean, it's fantastic for them, but in terms of replica clothing, it's about, for us revivalists, it's been unbelievable.
So that perfectly leads over to my next question about how Japan has influenced the rest of the world in terms of this style.
I think we've got to remember, in terms of fashion, there were two Japanese invasions, if you like, and the first one had nothing to do with revival, which was during the bubble period. Major designers, brands, if you like, launched in Paris, I think in 84 or 85, Izumayaki, Yoshi Yamamoto, Comme des Garçons, and there were some others, but they were the ones that really came through. And that was all about Japanese minimalism. As Westerners, because we don't, including myself here, we don't know that much about Japan and about Buddhism and so forth, but we immediately think of the word Zen when we think of minimalism, because maybe we don't fully understand it, but that's our Western understanding. And we look at Japanese minimalism in clothing and so forth, and we kind of understand it. I think the part that the West understands much less was an invasion, which is kind of still going on, which is this invasion of mid-century style, which is not minimalist. It's actually about layers, different layers. It's about provenance, quality. It's about all kinds of things which are nothing to do with that first wave of Japanese fashions and styles. Yes, I mean, we know what it's about. It's just the second wave. So Japan has influenced two different levels of fashion. One was pure fashion, minimalistic fashion. And then the other one has been this area which you could link with the denim scene, with the hipster scene, with the motorcycle scene. It's multifaceted. And yeah, that's what Mensphile is about, that those same facets are to be found in Mensphile and also to be found in Clutch and Lightning.
But so what does the future then look like for this Japanese heritage or revival style?
That's something that if I knew, I probably wouldn't be talking to you now. I'd be in Hawaii sipping a pina colada. But I don't know, but one can speculate. I mean, what's always happened with these style scenes is that they constantly change. I mean, look at denims. I mean, when the replica denims first came out, they were pure replicas. I mean, they looked like 1940s jeans or 1950s jeans or whatever. And now lots of people, for example, have gone over to fashion style, so narrow jeans. I mean, it will constantly change. How it will change, I can't say. I think technical clothing and technical fabrics will play a part in this. For example, there are brands like Snowpeak, for example. It's not a heritage brand in any way, and it's not a replica brand, but it's about outdoor life. It's contemporary. It uses sometimes historical shapes and things. I think that the materials they use, which are highly technical, like real waterproof materials, Prima Loft, all these highly technical things, they might cross over into heritage wear. So you make an absolutely perfect 1940s jacket, but instead of making it from leather, you make it from another fabric, which is 100% waterproof, which is very warm and so on and so forth. I can see us going through a phase of that, although that's just speculation. I don't know that for sure.
If that happens, would you then feature it in Men's Fashion?
Oh, we actually do a section called our technical section. Right. Because if you're really into outdoor life, if you're really into motorcycling, and you don't mind getting on the bike when it's torrential rain and riding 50 miles, which, believe me, makes you very wet and sad, the thing that's missing, there are very few brands doing it who actually make highly technical motorcycle wear which looks great. And when I say looks great, you know, that if you're riding a 60s panhead Harley or 50s panhead Harley or a nice shovel head or whatever, and you want to look like you're a 60s guy going along on his bike, you're never going to find any technical wear that looks like that. But there are a few companies. There's actually a Japanese company called Westride, for example. And there are other brands who are doing technical stuff that you can ride on your bike that looks great. But only in Japan. I don't think there's anyone outside of Japan doing truly technical wear. There's people experimenting with it in the UK, in Italy as well, but it's Japan is leading the way once again.
So I think we're at the point now where we're getting into the questions section of this podcast. And I do have a few questions for you that I just wanted to quickly run by you as sort of the ending. So what's your favorite Japanese brand?
Oh, that's a dangerous question, Thomas. that's a very good question. Yeah, that's a really good one. Oh, gosh.
I mean, you could maybe pick out a category or something.
I think
denim or boots or whatever you want.
For me, it's actually because I love denim and everything, but I love outerwear. There's a whole bunch of brands. I mean, there's some of the Toyo brands, of course, the Real McCoys. They're actually the usual suspects because they are good. Full Count, I've had some beautiful outerwear from them. I do wear denim, but my denim is made by a Japanese man, but not in Japan. He's based in New York. He's called Bowery Blue. And he makes handmade denim, single needle. It's just him. He cuts out the jeans. He sews them up with a single needle. A really amazing, amazing stuff. So I guess in terms of denim, he would be my number one. But with the other bigger brands, the big ones are good. Westride, that makes the motorcycle wear, is a great brand. It's, you know, for motorcycle wear, it's fantastic. there are few brands in Japan that are not good. Very few. I mean, I'm going through different brands in my head. I mean, there's brands like Groovin' High. Groovin' High is a very small brand. It's run by one man. He's called Ricky. It's a great brand. I mean, there are very few that aren't doing something interesting. And the main, first of all, the quality is always there. So you don't have to worry about that. The thing that you always look for is the taste of the designer. And their taste for picking ideas from the right ideas from the mid-century period is incredible. There are very few who don't offer something that I wouldn't love. So I'm going to cop out a little bit, even though I've mentioned Bowery Blue and I've mentioned Groovin' High, Toyo and so forth. But yeah, there's a lot.
I know it's a tough question.
Yeah, it's a tough question.
Right. You know, going back to your first visit or maybe your most memorable experience that you had in Japan, what's that?
I think my most memorable was my first visit to the Real McCoys, which was in the 90s. And it's where somehow I went into one store because there's a street market in Ueno, which is reputedly the first place in post-war Japan that sold American goods, original surplus from the US Army, of course, that was occupying Japan, unfortunately, in that period. But nevertheless, they were selling American military goods. And I went to that street market in the 90s, and they were selling replica goods by then, really interesting stuff. And I started to think, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable. Why are these people doing this? But I'm really glad they are. And then maybe on my next trip, I just stumbled across the Real McCoys. They had a store in Dakanyama then. I just literally stumbled across it. I went down a couple of steps into a little shop, and the whole style world that I'd been trying to find since the 70s and occasionally stumbled across one original bit here and one original bit there. It was all in one shop, but they were replicas. And of course you could wear them without destroying them because they were new and, you know, had a few years wearing them.
Different sizes and everything, so you can actually get something that fit as well.
Well, you could get the fit, you could get everything. And that was the, I think, yeah, that was when I started to think, oh my gosh, there's something going on here. And then in my head, it all linked up with the Toyo stuff that had been sold at American Classics in London and similar brands that had been sold by the Duffer of St. George. And then I stumbled across Lightning magazine or Free and Easy a little later, and I realized this is something that's big. And then you started to see people, because I was really into motorcycles. I saw a lot of old motorcycles, and I was thinking, where do these guys get the clothes they're wearing? And then it all came together. And by the late 90s, I realized that Japan was the center of the universe when it came to collecting mid-century clothing and replica clothing. I have stuff from the 90s, which is collectible in itself, even though it's a replica of something from the 40s.
Yeah, of course. But what's your favorite place then in Japan?
Ah, that's a good question. I think Tokyo in particular is about walking. And there are, you know, some great walks. And you can walk from Shibuya Station up through Meiji Dori, Cat Street, and then through Uru Harajuku to the Lewis Leather Shop. I mean, Lewis Leathers obviously is a British brand, but very, very important in Japan because of this interest in credible and authentic histories. Lewis Leathers is a landmark, effectively, but you can do that walk up through Cat Street, or you can walk through the little streets of Daikanyama, there's an amazing cafe. It's not a cafe, it's really a bar called Streamline Cafe in Daikanyama. The guy only wears 40s clothing. The whole thing is like a 1920s or 30s ship inside. And he runs everything himself. So, and then you can walk along and go into a great vintage store, a totally amazing vintage store. Then you can walk up to the top of Daikanyama and you can see a bunch of really beautifully presented fashion stores, people like Nanamika and so forth. So in terms of visual experiences, Tokyo is just full of them. I mean, just really, really full of them. So I haven't got one place, but I've got these walks I like to go on, which take me around areas and you just see one great and interesting thing after another.
Yeah, I really want to go back and follow you on that walk. I've only been once, so
yes.
That sounds pretty amazing. The last question I have for you is, what does Made in Japan mean to you?
Made in Japan is always about quality. There's never any question there. About care taken, care in the product, pride in the product as well. And I'm not just trying to say good things. When I hear Made in Japan, I don't really see any negatives. I just think of all the different positives. Great taste as well, which is the way that people are able to see the West from the outside and choose the best things in a way which happens to suit my own taste. Doesn't suit everybody's, but it suits mine very well. And that's the same with motorcycles and interesting cars and interior design and lots of other things as well. So or ceramics, for example, we haven't even really mentioned ceramics, and they're incredibly important in Japanese culture, but also show the high levels of taste and understanding of proportion that Japanese culture seems to promote. So yeah, Made in Japan, quality basically.
Right. Well, that brings us to the end of this interview and this episode. So thank you so much, Nick, for taking the time to talk to me today. And I hope the listeners out there learned something. Again, it was a pleasure having you on. And if listeners by now haven't already found you and Men's File, please tell them, where should they go?
The best place to find us is actually on our Instagram account, which is at Men's File Magazine. Please give us a like, please wave to us or give us a thumbs up or something. Nice to hear from you.
Where can people buy the magazine?
The easiest place to buy it is actually directly from Japan, and it is very efficient. It's on our website, which is www.lightningclutch.com. But that is also on our Instagram at Men's File Magazine.
Great. So, Nick, once again, thank you for coming on to the show.
Thank you.
And to everyone listening, we'll catch you in the next one.